Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Thanks for listening to Creative Control. While I have you here, please consider supporting Youth Empowerment and Support Services, otherwise known as YES. Based in Edmonton, Alberta, YES provides immediate and low-barrier overnight and day shelter, temporary supportive housing, and individualized wraparound supports for young people aged 15 to 24. They work collaboratively within a network of care focused on the prevention of youth homelessness by providing youth with the necessary supports to stabilize their housing, improve their well-being, build life skills, connect with community, and avoid re-entry into homelessness. Learn more about how to donate or otherwise support YES by visiting yess.org.
Hey, this is Adam from Toronto, and I support Creative Control because Vish is full stop one of the best arts interviewers in Canada, or anywhere in the world, really. He approaches every episode like he's known the artist for years, creating a conversational atmosphere that gets straight to the heart of the work. No one else in podcasting gets it quite right like he does, with a mixture of meticulous research, wise artistic insights, and well-humored personal connections. I proudly support Vish and Creative Control on Patreon. You should, too.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Maximilian Turnbull is a gifted and prolific multi-instrumentalist, songwriter, producer, engineer, and singer based in Toronto, Ontario. Since first emerging and releasing records as Slim Twig, Turnbull has gone on to lead bands like Badge Epic Ensemble and Symphony Orchestra, and collaborate with his wife, Meg Remy, in her work as US Girls. Turnbull is often busy making and playing music, and beyond touring with US Girls, 2023 has seen him release two great albums via Telephone Explosion, a fantastic symphony orchestra record called Radiant Music, which came out in May, and now Air, Light, and Harmony by Badge Epic Ensemble, which is available on November 3rd. Max returns to this show to discuss those bands and those records, and also stuff like touring with toddler twins, what it can be like touring and speaking with Bill Callahan, composing music, but also composting music, sampling your own band and conceptual complexity, working with his friend Michael Rolt and starting the psychedelic R&B pop band Symphony Orchestra, when your kids like the stuff you make and also the stuff you like, future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners just like you who follow and subscribe to this donor-driven podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol. That is the primary source of revenue for this show and all the work that I put into this show. So if you can afford it, and you feel like supporting me and my efforts, please support the Creative Control Podcast on Patreon. It means a lot. Thank you. With additional support from Blackbird Music, a wonderful record store with bricks and mortar locations in Edmonton and Calgary, Alberta, and a website where you can order stuff yourself, blackbird.ca. Say you want the new Badge Epic Ensemble record, or if you want the new Symphony Orchestra record, Radiant Music, whatever it is you want, just go to blackbird.ca, type in what you want, see if they've got it, and if they've got it, they'll ship it right to your house. It's just that simple. Plus, in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee, respectively, in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is episode 814 of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented Maximilian Turnbull, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hey Max, how's it going?
Good. How are you, Vish?
Oh, I'm very well. Thanks for asking. Where in the world are you?
I am in my little garage home studio, which is just underneath our apartment. It was formerly a garage, and now we make music down here.
Oh.
Or record the odd podcast, I guess, too.
That's what garages are for. One of the most prominent podcast guys was all about his garage. Yeah. Is that a recent development for you to have taken over the garage?
Yeah, like subsequent to pandemic, we put down roots here. So, you know, we sort of investigated the notion of possibly getting a house and then realized, nope, that's not going to be possible as musicians unless we wanted to live, you know, 5 hours away from Toronto. So the alternate was to renovate what was formerly a garage space beneath our apartment. And we're lucky that we have a really great friend who's also our landlord and have come up with a really great arrangement for that. So amazing. We kind of just in the same sort of week had a downstairs, which formerly didn't exist, to our apartment and two kids. So it was kind of a bit of a revolution in lifestyle.
Yeah. Well, that's great. I'm sorry. Did you say it's a proper recording studio or more of a practice facility?
It's like a in the box recording nook, I would say. Yeah.
Okay. So have you made anything in the garage that we've heard on a Badge record or anywhere else?
Yeah, the new Badge album, Air, Light, and Harmony, was essentially done here.
Oh.
So it's, which was, following up from Clouds of Joy, which had been recorded in like three studios proper, an extensive cast of like almost 20 musicians, not all at the same session, but this record is sort of a come down from that approach, and much more sort of the energy was, instead of doing like these massive canvases, like sort of sketches, and the garage studio is perfect for that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, before we get deeper into all of this great work that you've been up to, you did allude to your family there. And I, as someone who is familiar with them and friendly, how I must ask, because I'm a polite person, you see? I know it's some people think I'm just killing time, but I like to ask how people are doing because I'm civilized. I try to be a nice person. So my question is
in real life and on podcast.
Yeah, exactly. That's how I try to be. So how are Meg? How are your children doing?
Good. Everyone's good, you know. We're mostly healthy, you know. We got back from tour not too long ago and we take our kids with us, and it seems like when you travel you inevitably get some mysterious kind of cough, but we've shook most of those cobwebs and everyone's good and we're happy to be home again.
Now just for those who may be wondering, it's not really anyone's business, but I'm curious, how old are your children again? They must be what, 2, 3, something like that?
Right in the middle. Yeah, we have two and a half year old boys.
Right. Now, and they're twins. For those who have missed Meg's previous appearances on the show, and maybe we've talked about it too, Max, you got twins. You got two for the price of one, so to speak.
This is true.
Now, those of us who have traveled on tour with bands, depending on the dynamic, it can be the case that any one adult in the course of a trip will start to act like a little child. And you have to deal with their personality quirks and their... And people could lose their minds a little bit sometimes on tour, and they regress. And so I'm used to that. I've been that guy. You know, we've all been there, I think. What is it like to actually tour with actual toddlers? How difficult is that, if it is at all? Was it smooth sailing the whole time?
It's been really good. I feel like, you know, the sort of regression that you're talking about, musicians can often resemble teenagers or something on tour, where these guys are truly toddlers. So it's like a bit of a different energy, but it's difficult, but it works for us. You know, Meg and I just sort of joke when we have come off the road, the two times we've done it now, that we didn't actually go on tour. We just did a weird family vacation that involves playing concerts most nights. But we have a dear friend who's also a musician that comes and helps out as the sort of third parent and sort of takes the boys from soundcheck on, kind of thing.
Yeah. It's funny, those two kids, they don't know no different. They don't know that they're doing something unique, but and they're probably too young to retain these memories, I'm thinking. So, yeah, it's just interesting. I wonder how it's going to impact them in a long-term way.
Yeah, I mean, I first went on tour when I was 18, and they've done it at 2 years old. and we're not anticipating that we're going to be, like, touring for the next 20 years, so we're trying to, like, savor it and, you know, do our due diligence with journaling and things like that to try and have some memories that we can produce for them, but... Yeah, it's like, it's, you know, I think being around musicians and being around music certainly has been a huge part of their formation that I think will stick with them.
Yeah.
But, you know, as far as remembering it, probably not.
Yeah. In terms of the material conditions, so the experiential aspect of touring, you've done it before there was a pandemic, you've done it during a pandemic. What's it kind of like out there? What's your perspective on how it feels to be a touring... And sorry, you just alluded to it, and I don't know if you were just being realistic, or like, you know, maybe we won't be touring for the next 20 years. I couldn't help but wonder if that was a comment on the kind of actual conditions of touring and how viable it is. All this to say, can you, from your perspective, give us a sense of what it's kind of like out there as we're speaking right now?
I feel like my... observations about it are so specific because I did a lot of touring before the pandemic that was great, but sort of unremarkable in the scheme of like what the experience of touring might be like. You know, it's like uncomfortable for your body, but it's good fun socially until it's not. And then the shows are always like the high point, and it's a sort of strange dynamic of waiting around and doing very little and then finally doing, you know, this 45 minutes of great activity that sort of sustains your energy. So that was sort of, you know, the conditions previous to pandemic stuff. And then following pandemic, like we've just jumped into it with kids. So I find it like my experience of touring now is characterized much more by like traveling with my family in a minivan and meeting the band at the venue and then, you know, having the band pack up while Meg and I peace out to like go parent again. It's much more characterized by that experience, which feels very particular, than it is by like the shift in material conditions or the shift in audience attitudes. I feel like people are on their phones less, which is something that I was pleasantly surprised by just getting back from US Girls tour. I feel like before the pandemic, that was such a bugaboo of like concerts are so difficult because everyone's just like in your grill with a phone the whole time and not really engaging. And that was one observation that I think I was positively struck by, is that people that are at these shows are pretty excited to just have an encounter that exists beyond the devices, you know? And I feel like for many people that the experience of the pandemic and all that has made that a very binary thing, you know, between phone experiences and real life ones, and concerts are certainly in the latter camp. So that was a cool thing to see.
That's actually quite heartening, to be honest. People are, well, I'm out of the house and away from my screens. I'd like to keep it that way as much as possible. That's good. Yeah. No, that's great. Well, I appreciate those updates and those perspectives. Thank you for that. As we're speaking, I feel like your excellent band, Badge Epic Ensemble, is maybe in a new state in terms of its configuration, I think. I'm basing this on some photographs I've seen recently where I'm like, I don't know if I know everyone now. Can you, you first of all, tell us what the state of the current band is in terms of who's in it and maybe what precipitated some of the changes?
Well, I guess broadly, I think of Badge Epic Ensemble as a sort of modular unit, but there's sort of eight instrumentalists that are core group members. So Jay Anderson on drums, Chris Bazant on guitar, Gio Rossati on bass, Ali O'Brien on flute, Ed Squires on conga, Karen Ng on saxophone, myself on variety of things, and Edwin DeHuey, who's maybe the person that you're thinking, oh, I don't know who that very young-looking... the joke is he looks like Walter Becker, and he's obsessed with Steely Dan. So the young 25-year-old-looking Walter Becker fellow is my friend Edwin, who joined as of Clouds of Joy. So yeah, I'm kind of in a, it's a modular thing. And, you know, if I were to add one more person, I'd say Dorothea Poss, who we've now played a couple shows with, who, did the vocal arrangements on Clouds and has sung with us live too.
Okay.
But essentially it's that eight core instrumentalists, and it's sort of at this point, a sort of ad hoc who's available and who's interested and let's go from there proposition when we're doing shows and recording.
Is that a challenge to have a modular band where a key person might not be available?
Yes, which is precisely why it's kind of at the condition now of like, who wants to, who's around, you know, this is like, it doesn't come down to how much money there is, but I, you know, with shows, it's just sort of like, this is what we can do, who wants to do it? And I kind of think of it as a creative challenge to, figure that out, you know? So the good thing about the modularness of it is that I can like sub in for a few different instruments. You know, if we don't have Gio on bass, then I can sub in there. I can sub in on keys if Edwin's not available, and could play a little bit of guitar. So we're in a phase with the band where it's a make it work kind of thing.
Does Badge, and forgive me because I can't keep track of everyone and their activities. Has Badge ever done like extensive touring the way U.S. Girls might for a couple? I mean, at this point, I feel like you're doing a couple week chunks, maybe. But has Badge ever done like extensive touring?
No, we've not. Yeah. I think just by nature of being like the small version of the group is often six people, you know, which is a pretty high threshold to clear as far as making that materially possible. So we, you know, we formed the band kind of and very quickly did this like cross Canada, I say in air quotes because it was four shows, but on either coast with Bill Callahan. And that was a really fantastic experience. And we did some shows opening for U.S. Girls because there was so much shared personnel. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we kind of, it's just been a mostly Toronto thing. I feel like I'm in a fortunate position where I can kind of get those touring experiences and, from doing U.S. girl stuff. And then when I come to the Badge, I'm just a little bit more level headed about what's possible. Cause I find that one thing about the touring economy is that it's sort of like, it thrives on the dreams of musicians, you know, people who would love nothing more than to like, oh, let's go tour Europe, even though it's not materially feasible. Yeah, so, yeah. I just try to keep a level head and acknowledge that I've been in a fortunate place to play internationally. And this is a group that's sort of more oriented around the recording experience of producing records and playing more locally.
Oh, I appreciate that level headedness. And I, as you sort of allude to, it's based on various unfortunate factors on some level, but also the reality of what it's like to be a musician right now. You alluded to Bill Callahan there. Sorry, how many dates did you do with Bill?
Four.
Yeah.
Which was really early on in the group, and it was sort of an experience I think really solidified a certain chemistry. And it's cool that we have had that experience of doing a little bit of travel together and have had the experience of like meeting audiences cold.
Yeah.
And being able to win people over or have that sensation, but it's not really a part of the repertoire at present.
Yeah. Did you get to interact much with Bill? What was the experience like overall?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you must have interviewed Bill, right?
Bill's, yeah, I've interviewed Bill a few times. He's been on this particular show a couple times. And once, how many times have I talked to Bill? Yeah, a couple, three, four times, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, so he's very, as he is in song, sort of like wryly funny, and but hard to feel totally comfortable around or get a straight read on, just due to his sort of deadpan nature. So there's definitely a few green room interactions, and like had the sensation that we were chosen by him somehow to play those shows, which was very flattering. But yeah, I don't, he sort of speaks in like little aphoristic fragments or something, and you kind of do your best to to sort out what he's suggesting.
I don't want to get too inside baseball here, but I want to share something because it does irk me a little bit.
Yeah.
Bill has been on this show a few times now, or again, I can't remember if it's two or three times. And I want to be careful here. I love Bill and I respect him deeply, so I don't want to say anything that might offend him or his audience or whatever. But and I don't think I am. I'm telling tales out of school necessarily, but I have kind of a running joke that when I'm editing episodes with people, I often end up like I end up with a raw file when I'm mixing tracks, and that let's say that's 60 minutes. And then as I go through it a second time, I'm taking out some, you know, sentences that get restarted. I'm taking out ums and ahs. I really try to, I just try to make the thing sound as good as it can and for the guest to come across as well as it can. So that 60-minute raw file after all of that, that might be 56 minutes.
Sure, sure.
You know, because I've taken out some dead air and whatnot. So as I was releasing Bill episodes, some people would come out of the woodwork to be like, man, you're cutting him off. you cut him off. You're cutting him off there. And what they don't know is that if a Bill chat, if Bill and I have a chat and it's a 60-minute raw file, I can, it's like 45 minutes by the time I'm done because I've taken out a lot of dead space.
Yeah.
And I'm just waiting for him. It's great. Like, I love the experience of talking to him. Obviously, he's just such a legend. I look up to him so much. I love his music.
Yeah.
But he is someone, all I'm getting at is he speaks, and I think you're saying it too, to some extent. He speaks not only in riddles, but haltingly, deliberately.
Sure. Yeah, the sentence and he'll start, ends there. rather than
he'll start to say something.
Part.
Yeah, he'll start to say something and 15 seconds go by.
Yeah.
Before he completes the sentence. And so the end result is people are mad at me because it sounds like I've made it. I listen back sometimes. I'm like, it's not a choppy edit. He just wasn't going to go. He doesn't say anything else.
Right.
He stopped. So then it's 15 seconds of me moving that. Anyway, sorry. This was a little bit of a tangent. I'm just giving some people an inside perspective on what it's like. And you are too, to interact with someone like Bill, who's like brilliant, but enigmatic, and you got to hang on every word. Anyway, sorry. Thank you for indulging that. Does what I'm saying resonate with you in terms of your interactions with him?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's certain people who, you know, thinking about his music, you know, there's an open-endedness to it that's very inviting for speculation, you know?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
that experience, that kind of encounter with stuff, can make some people uncomfortable. You know, vividly remember him performing. I'm a fan, but I'm not so super in depth with like song titles and things. But he has one song about taking prisoners swimming as like a prison guard or something like that, and it's just so, you're trying to get your bearings sort of morally in the song. Just simply in terms of the images and what they're suggesting to you. It's just so deeply subjective, and I just really appreciate that about his work, and I think he's sort of like that in person too, you know?
Yeah.
You're left to wonder.
Yeah. Yeah, he's not one to pussyfoot around. But I think everything is done with a spirit of, well, he's certainly a very smart and clever guy. And I think there's empathy there, but every once in a while, you're like, uh-oh, what's happening? what side of the song am I supposed to be on here, you know? So anyway, I do love him and I love speaking to him, but it is an example I encounter where if I get hate mail, it's usually because I've cut off Bill Callahan.
Sure.
And I have to write back and be like, no, you don't understand. It might, and I mean, it does make me question, like, should I just put it out the raw audio so that people can actually hear what it's like to interact with him? But anyway, yeah. We'll see what happens if he's ever on the show again. Anyway, that was a fairly wild tangent, but it's nice to hear that you bonded over the experience as bandmates getting on the road and whatnot. So let's talk a little bit about Aerolite and Harmony. My understanding is that this concludes a trilogy that began with Nature, Man, and Woman, which came out in 2019. And then a couple years later, we had Future, Past, and Present. Now we have Air, Light, and Harmony. Obviously a nominal connection. What do you makes this a trilogy as a band, per se?
Well, I think essentially like each of these records takes an approach where we compost materials from the preceding album. So with Nature, Man, and Woman, we took some drum stems and flute stems and created a new composition based on using previously recorded stuff from the debut album, which had come out a few months before. So the idea was just to make use of like these studio quality sounds and create new compositions from them, like in a more of a home recorded environment, essentially. And that's what we did with Future, Past, and Present as well, where took stems and sounds from Self Help, our second proper album, and made a new composition, the title track, recombining and using those old elements. So I don't like to leave scraps on the table, you might say.
Yeah.
And now with Aerolite and Harmony, it's sort of like an album with several compositions that repurpose like fragments of music from previous releases. Huh. So that's sort of the concept of it.
So there's something inherently reflective about your own band in this process that I want to ask you about, but I would be remiss if I didn't step back to ask you about your use of the word composting. I've not heard musicians suggest that they compost their own material. Is that music speak that I'm just not hip to? What does that mean? Where did you get that from?
I guess it's just a manner of speaking for me, but I find myself often like in a place where it would be cool to write a tune, but I don't have someone playing drums. I could pull up some loops, or I could just dig into my catalog of stems, you know, having access to these wonderfully recorded drums and start chopping them up and slowing them down and pitching them this way and that, and start songwriting based on using in-house sounds. And then I sort of took that a little bit further and started chopping up flute sounds and making new, you know, melodic fragments that way. And, you know, there's such an emphasis like on kind of creating a period feel with some of the bad stuff of like, really appreciating the texture of like 70s records. Mm-hmm. And for me, this is one of the ways in which we can kind of contemporize what we're doing, by having a sort of self-reflective, conception of the band and by using the live recorded elements in multiple ways, you know, trying to get really good takes and doing that thing where it's kind of we have a few songs that are like a bit of a flex of like, there's no overdubs, there's no edits. It's like, you know, 5-6 people in a studio, this is what it sounds like. And I like to go the opposite direction of getting the clippers out and making something that's, you know, a little more contemporary in its approach as well, with the same sort of textures and blurring the lines between those techniques too.
That's really fascinating. It reminds me of, I'm not sure what prompted you to think of such an idea, whether it was any artist or something. I understand the practicality of what you're describing, but that's just an interesting mm-hmm. impulse to have, because what it reminds me of is, I mean, earlier this year I re-immersed myself in the world of Beastie Boys because Adam Horovitz from the band and I had a chat, and I reread their book, Beastie Boys book, and mm-hmm. they had a sort of, they came upon, they made a similar sort of realization. It had more to do with the fact that they were paying out exorbitant amounts of money for samples.
Yeah.
And I think it was Adam Yauch who was like, why don't we just sample ourselves?
Yeah.
So their hip hop songs, which, you know, this was just, I mean, sorry. I think you know where I'm going with this, Max. Like that to me seemed like a unique approach in their mode. And when I asked Adam, you know, was anyone else? That's to me, that's a really ingenious way of doing contemporary music and the sample aesthetic, but using your own original material. And I asked him, like, was anyone else doing that? And he was like, I don't know. Yeah. Maybe that's how he answered most of the questions. But can you talk about your own impulse to be like, wait a minute, why don't I just sort of sample ourselves? Where did that kind of come from beyond the practical aspect?
Yeah, I mean, the first album I ever kind of released professionally in 2009 was As Slim Twig, and the album's called Contempt. And the approach that I was using at that time was sample-based. I was making beats, essentially, you know, with a little Boss SP-303 sampler. And that was sort of just like my genesis as a musician, was kind of like trying to make music that resembled like the RZA and Madlib, at least instrumentally. Yeah. And from that kind of got onto the wavelength of getting into all the records that the sort of generation from the mid 90s forward through to the mid 2000s, just learning about the sample sources of all that music from these wonderful hip hop producers. And that was sort of my entry point into making music. And then, you know, years passed and I started making music, you know, with instruments, guitars and keyboards and drums, and getting bands going and this kind of thing. Yeah. And that led to the Badge Epic Ensemble. And all of a sudden I find myself like the head of a jazz funk ensemble, like being someone who doesn't have any classical training, whose grasp of music theory is like a sort of, I understand it on a sort of conceptual and cerebral level, but my fingers don't do the thing where you play scales and stuff at an incredible speed. I just don't operate that way as a musician. So I find it sort of jarring at times when I realize that like I'm the band leader of this group that's marketed as like a jazz funk sort of thing. Consciously, like that's my decision to present it that way. Yeah. But doing this other approach sort of allows me to get in touch with how I landed in this spot. And I think having a few different approaches under the banner of Badge just is a sort of source of comfort for me to remind myself, oh yeah, I'm not like pursuing this music along the line of being a virtuoso. I'm pursuing it on a sort of conceptual, cerebral curiosity that's personal to me, and I'm sort of most at home on a production front, so chopping things up and treating sounds and kind of arranging in this sort of collage manner. Those are the skills that kind of I employ to create the live records, and I sort of like to complete the circle by then also still pursuing collage music essentially with these ingredients that are produced as a result of making the live records.
This is where it gets a little complicated for me in terms of the inherent origin aspects of a song. When you play pieces, just to differentiate between what you just said about the live band, you're talking about the albums you make where the band is in a room and recording as one, as opposed to playing live. I just want to make that distinction because that's where my question's going. When Badge plays live, when I've seen you play live, it has elements of free improv, I suppose, even though I don't think that's what's going on, but it has that freedom. Sorry, maybe I shouldn't. There's no improv in Badge per se, is there?
There is, but it's pretty reined in. Yeah. You know, we don't go on there without, oh, let's just see what happens. It's like we have certain compositions where the form can be open and more so to more latitude to certain people in the group, you know, who are most comfortable with that.
Right.
But yeah, that's like in the mix, but I wouldn't say it's the dominant technique.
Right. So when you take to the stage as Badge and you play pieces from any one of these records from this trilogy, are you pretty faithful to the trilogy arrangements of the songs?
Well, it's interesting. We've not really performed any of the collage stuff. Whenever we've performed live, we sort of stick with the stuff that we've made conventionally in the studio, and the kind of collage material is sort of, for one thing, like Nature Man and Woman, it's an album that has three songs on it, sort of an EP, I guess.
Right,
and
of course.
One of the songs is this collage approach that's the title track. And Future, Past, and Present, same kind of thing. The concept of that record was releasing instrumental versions of all the songs that we had done collaboratively with vocalists, and including one new composition, which was a longer composition, one of these collage pieces, again, the title track. And then this latest album, Air, Light, and Harmony, is taking the idea of that we used to create those two compositions, which have never been performed live, and doing an album that uses some of those techniques more extensively.
Okay.
I would say.
Okay.
So we just haven't really had the opportunity to perform the collage stuff. It hasn't felt like an intuitive thing to do, but we're going to play a couple shows in Toronto in December. And I think that might be on the agenda, given that it's sort of more conceptually central to the latest release.
So you would play the collage arrangements for those shows in December?
I think so.
So that's
we haven't practiced yet. So
okay, this is where it gets sort of where I was going with this. Is that that's really? I mean, it's interesting and fascinating, but it's sort of weird. That's going to be. Sorry, maybe it won't be that weird, but you've. It just seems like the original song is going to be sleeping in this other song, and. You know what? I don't even know if I have a question. It just gets kind of meta. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it's just sort of like, what is this? This collage is like from the old. Like, could you do a medley where the old song melds into the collage, and would that make coherent? Would that be a coherent listening experience? Like, I may be overcomplicating this as I tend to do. I'm sorry, but it seems odd.
I feel like the deeper I get into this, I realize that my musical kink is like conceptual complexity, you know?
Yeah.
And it's not everyone's bag, but that's what does it for me. And that's the sort of the thread that I'm often pulling. I just like sort of, you know, I guess tying back to the Bill Callahan thing, I really like ambiguity. I like sort of choose your own adventure approach of encountering music where you hear something and it's not immediately straightforward the sensation you should be having.
Yeah.
And I like extending that to sort of being very self-reflexive about what this band is, you know? So creating a music video that takes the form of like one of these long-winded rock docs with a talking head explaining the history of the band and all the archival footage. Like we did a music video like that, and having a box set that's like a CD, five CD box set with a Blu-ray that has a, you know, like as if the band is a classic rock archetype, you know? I like playing with these forms and having a kind of meta complexity that, I don't know. It makes it interesting for me personally.
No, it's like, and it's a really inclusive complexity. Like the spirit of Badge is one that if you're watching the band and you're lucky to get to see them, it moves you physically and emotionally. So it's not insular, if I may.
Yeah.
I think that's a really key for those who may be unfamiliar. We're not talking about some, I don't know, experimental white noise group or something. It's it's quite the opposite.
I feel that the just to tie that up, like I feel like the group functions in a few different capacities, and one of them is like Max is sort of conceptualizing about things, and then the other is like, oh, there's like 6 to 8 human beings who are just making music together, and if you encounter that live, that's what you're experiencing, is like the chemistry of these individuals rather than like what I think about the record and spin it as later, you know, which is a whole other sphere of the music, I guess, that you can digest as much or as little as you want.
Well, again, and the complexity we're describing is sort of conceptual. Like you have to kind of read about the complexity as opposed to feeling like, what the hell is this as you're listening to it? You know what I mean? Like it's not jarring to listen to. It's just if you're paying attention.
Yeah.
I hate to overuse this term because it connotes comic book films or whatever, but you're creating a weird little multiverse for Badge with the trilogy, I feel like, with the subtle callbacks, and it's like Easter eggs on some level, but they're also not obvious in any way. It's recontextualization like this. It's very interesting, and the deconstructionist, it's just very fascinating to know that's how you constructed these pieces, but as I was trying to say, I don't think it hits you over the head as a listener.
Sure.
You know what I'm getting at? Like the theory of it all.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. It's like, you know, you go to an art gallery, you can read the little thing beside the art piece, or you can just look at it, you know?
Yes, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. This interview might be the most complicated aspect of these exercises, and I'm sorry if I've muddled things further.
No.
On a different end of the spectrum, symphony orchestra. This is another group you're in, and I want you to first of all, what is symphony orchestra? Who's in it?
Symphony Orchestra is a songwriting partnership and recording project between myself and my friend, the singer-songwriter, instrumentalist, producer, Michael Rault.
Right. Now, I say it's on the other end of the spectrum because I think this is among the most accessible music this might be some of the most accessible music I think you've ever made. It is confection. It's like pop confection. It stirred. Mm-hmm. I pushed play on this record for the first time, and everyone at the kitchen table just involuntarily started moving to, I believe it's the title track, Radiant Music. And so that's a different kind of instant connection. Where did this project sort of emanate from, and did you kind of articulate what you wanted to do together? Because it's really beautiful, and I'm just curious, again, I hope it's not disparaging to say it's the most accessible thing you've done.
No.
Do you agree with that sentiment?
Yeah, I think it was sort of formulated with that in mind for it to be, song forms that are, you know, you can play with convention like that. It sort of like allows for the convention to be visible, or you can play with convention by tossing it out the window. This is definitely like playing with the convention in a way where it's visible to people. These are songs.
Yeah. So is that Michael's domain is not far outside of this kind of realm. Is that fair?
Yeah, he's a singer-songwriter.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. So what were the challenges in this union, per se, in terms of getting ideas you both had across in this pop-centric manner?
Well, Michael and I have been friends for a long while, and I think the music that we make is sort of contrasts in possibly counterintuitive ways. If you listen to things in like a sort of niche capacity, we've done some. Yeah, he's played on some Badge stuff, and we've done some U.S. Girls recordings together, and just very. He played on the last Slim Twig record, so. There's always been that collaboration, but we wanted to sort of like up the stakes of just how collaborative it was and create some songs, the two of us. And I think it's just a cool fusion of the fact that we have different skills. You know, Michael's a fantastic lead singer, for instance, and harmonizer, and like a fantastic arranger of harmony vocal. And he also has like just the best feel, you know, that sort of mysterious quantity known as feel on a variety of instruments. Like his feel on drums is so particular, and his feel on bass is just like so deeply funky, and he can like interlock the arrangement between bass and drum sort of in his mind in a sort of preconceived way, and create something beautiful. You know, and my skills, I think, that I was bringing to this are just sort of like a cerebral dimension to like chords, chord progressions that have like a counterintuitive harmonic flavor to them that is compelling. And I really like writing lyrics, and my lyrics are would you be surprised kind of cerebral and sort of into the like notions about consciousness and the experience of consciousness. So I was writing from that place and sort of bringing my skills as a writer, both with chords and words, and Michael's skills as a arranger and instrumentalist and singer, and sort of, you know, throwing that all into a big gumbo and creating something that we both liked, which is probably like a little bit left of center for people who love Michael Rault records, and a little bit more you know, closer to the conventional song forms for people who like Badge. So something for everyone.
You know who also can kind of pull this trick off of doing something that's musically sophisticated and yet earwormy is that U.S. Girls. You know what I'm talking about there? Was that was playing? You live with U.S. Girls. You have children with U.S. Girls. You play in U.S. Girls. Is that a conscious or subconscious influence on a project like this one, or your work generally?
I feel that our life is a conscious influence on our work, and because we spend so much of our lives in parallel, then the work kind of takes on similar qualities, though they're expressed differently.
Yeah.
But like the symphony orchestra, the song forms are a lot closer to U.S. girls song forms. So maybe there's more of a commonality between this project and the U.S. girls records.
I mean, from the outside, if I think of Max Turnbull, I think, oh, well, Max has his different outlets. He's got the ability to express some manner of maybe a jonesing for pop music in his role in U.S. Girls. It's not his project. Mm-hmm. And then he's got his other, more expansive things. That's rather reductive, I suppose. But symphony orchestra seems like something of a meeting place between your more abstract impulses and the more pop-oriented stuff you do. Is that too simplistic? But what do you think?
No, I think that's fair to say. I just kind of got to a point where I realized I'm like a music producer, and I don't know precisely what that means, but
yeah.
I know that I'm not someone who's going to be in a band, the same band and only that band for 45 years.
Yeah.
I have to have a lot of different outlets to express different facets of my curiosity for music. So yeah, symphony orchestra is among them now. I don't think it's going to be an overly active concern. We made a record that we both really like and was an expression of our friendship and our like the sort of mutual point in our love of music. Because, there's certain songs or certain groups or certain production techniques and things that Michael and I both share and are finding like various expression in our respective other projects. But, yeah. Doing something where it was like, we're both obsessed with the way 10cc records sound and like the sort of strange tone of the first couple records by 10cc. That was like a big influence that was a mutual thing we would talk about, before we made this project. And then this was sort of a place where we could express that influence among others and other ideas together.
I know the band is called Symphony Orchestra. But I can't help but ask, are either of you familiar with Unknown Mortal Orchestra?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Because, do you see where I'm going here, Max? I thought, this got to be a touchstone. And then I was like, wait, orchestra? Because I was like, symphony orchestra is a bit of it's an interesting name to pluck out of the ether for this kind of music. And to the point, and I was like, why is it called Symphony Orchestra? And then as I was listening to it, I'm like, this kind of reminds me a little bit sometimes of Unknown Mortal Orchestra. And then I was like, orchestra? Yeah. What the hell? What's with the orchestra?
So I then wonder, I'm like, I don't know enough about that band to presume anything, but for us, like, the name is for me anyways, it's sort of like a humorous flex, because between the two of us, we can engineer, we can mix, we can produce, we can arrange, we can write, we can sing, we can dance, da-da-da, so it's just sort of a humorous flex.
Okay.
But I feel like that the Unknown Mortal Orchestra dude, like, he's the same kind of cut as Michael. I feel like he plays a bunch of the...
Yeah.
...bunch or predominantly, like, most of the instruments on the records, and it's, like,
yeah.
feel-oriented, and is informed by R&B on some level. That's Michael,
Like psychedelic R&B though, like it has that
again, Michael's like a Shuggie Otis kind of guy. It's like psyche, but it's so much to do with the playing and like the the intricacy of like Michael loves music from New Orleans, so that like Alan Toussaint kind of flavor. It's just like this funk that has to do with like how you carry your body or something. And transmuting that experience through an instrument. I just love that quality about Michael and wanted to make a record that was like, what would my favorite Michael Rault record sound like? It would sound like this.
Well,
so that was like my concept.
It's really spectacular. I'm a little sad to hear you say that you don't think it might be a going concern. That suggests you're not, no plans for a follow-up at this point.
We're cooking a song right now. So I don't mean to say, that was a one-off or something. It's just like we live on opposite coasts. I got two kids and, no plans to play live particularly. So it's like we're homies and next we cross paths, probably music will be to do with it. So there will be at least one new symphony orchestra song, sometime probably next year.
Okay. Well, that's lovely to hear. I love it. My family loves it.
Families love it. My kids they requested listening to this album, like, and not request is too polite, they demand listening to it like multiple times a day. You know, of all the music that Meg and I are involved with, it, like, this record was the one that they picked up on. And so we'd get them saying, "Michael Dadamikas now so super, super loud." That's what they would say, like, every day for like 2 months.
There's something, maybe people without kids may not appreciate this as much, but there's something extremely gratifying when your kids like the thing that you like. We've been having this experience this year in my family where they've glommed on to certain records. As we're speaking, what are the ones? Like, sorry, Max, as you might guess, I go through a lot of records to prepare for conversations like one, and it's just a constant cycle of like, okay, everyone, and sorry, because of the nature of my house, we're all kind of around, and I have it on when I'm cooking, and I have it on when I'm doing the dishes, and I have it on sometimes, and they get to hear it and either be like, "This sucks. When is this going to be done?" I'm like, "Well, I did the interview's Tuesday." Like, okay, good to know. And then other times, like, "What is this? This is the best thing I've ever heard." So we've had like a Buck 65 record that hasn't left rotation since it was introduced. We have, as we're speaking, there's a new excellent Neil Hamburger Christmas album called Seasonal Depression Suite. They love it. I have to play it every day. This is a record where they were requesting it all the time. But I'm telling you, that engagement from your kids with something you like, and I mean, good Lord, I was just telling my son today about we were walking to school, and I was like, "Do you ever think how weird and lucky it is that you got to interview Ad Rock from Beastie Boys?" And my son, without skipping a beat, said, "Always." You know, he resonated with him. I'm like, I'm just sorry. It just occurred to me that what I said to him after, I was fishing. I'm like, "So yeah, I'm a good dad."
Yeah.
And he went, "Yes, you're a great dad." So anyway, all this is
this nepotism thing, it works for you, son. Yes. Yes, dad.
He is a nepo baby. Yes, that's right. If he wants to pursue these things. No, would you agree? Like, when your kids like a thing you made or it's something to do with, there's nothing like that feeling, is there?
Well, it's interesting because I feel like there is a distinction between, like, the kids like the same stuff as you. That, like, does something to whatever pleasure center in your brain. And, like, that is one flavor, because my kids, they love the Harry Nilsson animated film The Point, which is, like, also my favorite movie.
And nice.
Like, check this out. And now they love it and are obsessed with it. It's a variation of that when it's something that you made, because I find the things I make after the fact that they've been released, I, like, acquire weird self-conscious dimension about them of like, "Oh, did this do well?" or whatever. So having to, like, listen to that album that you're sort of like feeling weird and cynical and self-conscious about, like, multiple times a day for a month, sort of was actually a helpful point in the process of digesting the experience of having released some music, you know, which is like a touchy point for many musicians, myself included. So I'm thankful to them that they made it clear that there was a very firm purpose for this music, even if it was a very localized one. You know, at least a purpose that I'm aware of, because the records, they have lives of their own that you don't get to know about. But it was nice to see, for sure.
Well, enjoy it while you can, because my son is 12. Yeah. And like I say, there's discernment now. Can this stop? I'm glad we don't have to listen to that record anymore. And I'm like, okay, that's fine. So, it's just lovely. It's an interesting experience to share such things with your family and get their feedback. I don't know. It means a lot to me anyway. So, all this to say, Max, you've alluded to some potential future plans for Badge and for Symphony Orchestra, if you're cooking up a song. Otherwise, what's sort of coming up next for you and your various projects?
I don't know. I feel like I'm kind of at a stage where I'm trying to wind down a lot of things. It's been a very productive, like, 5 or 6 years where I just had a million pots on several burners, and now I'm trying to complete the. I'm struggling to wrap up that metaphor. The culinary one, but
I'm hungry. I'm also a bit hungry. You hungry? It's I'm getting a little peckish. Yeah.
I mean, I just produced like a U.S. Girls live record that was sort of an archival project that I'm really pleased with, and we'll be playing some U.S. Girls shows in Europe in November, and I'm helping to produce an album by my friend Amanda from the band Ice Cream and Darlene Shrug.
Nice.
And there's a Darlene Shrug record that we just finished this week. So there's still stuff, but I'm trying to like work through it so I can get to a space of just sort of not knowing what I'm going to do instead of being like, there's these 7 unfinished records that need finishing, which has sort of been my creative condition for the last decade, it feels like.
Well, listen, for what it's worth, if you want to come back on the show to talk about any of those things, I really respect your work and your work ethic. So, again, for what it's worth, please consider it an open invitation. I can't wait to hear these things.
Thanks, Vish. You've been very generous with the space. I'm happy to be a repeat guest. So thank you.
I
appreciate what you do.
My pleasure. Now, if people want to learn more about you, Badge, Symphony Orchestra, anything else, these records, I think, that we've been talking about today are all have a home, rather, on Telephone Explosion Records, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong. And so that's one destination, I think. Again, we'll find out in a moment.
Yep.
Is there anywhere else you want to direct people online, or is there anything you need to correct about what I just said?
Nope. Just Badge, Epoque, EPOQUE.bandcamp.com would be a good spot.
Okay. As long as Bandcamp still exists by the time people hear this. I don't know. Every time I talk about an internet thing, I feel like I have to couch it this way now. Qualify it.
Yeah.
So by the time you hear this, if Twitter still exists, you know, like that's what I have to say. Yeah.
I feel like Instagram's probably not going anywhere, at least for the next couple of years. So
yeah,
maybe that's the spot. I'm on all the spots.
Okay. I'll link to as many of the spots as I possibly can. Interesting Thank point you. In the show. Normally I ask people if we can go out on a song, and I will ask you that, but we've got 2 records to really manage on some level. I have given people a flavor of one of them in the opening intro. So I think we should, and I don't, as I'm speaking to you, I don't know which one that is, but I'm just letting you know that if we don't get to both right now, they will have had a flavor of the other. So keep that in mind in case you're having trouble deciding.
Sure.
Max, if we can go out on a song from your recent and incredible catalog, what would you like to go out on and why?
Well, I guess if we could go chronologically, maybe there's something symphony orchestra related off the top. And we could go into Bowls at the end. I don't want to dominate, you know, your decision making here, but Bowls by Badge Epic Ensemble would be some good outro music. I just made a fantastic music video with my friend, Canada's greatest songwriter, in my opinion, Chris Cummings of Marker Starling.
Oh, nice.
And he did a wonderful job starring in this music video. So I would direct folks to check that out and check out the tune first, Bowls by Badge Epic Ensemble.
I love that Chris Cummings and Marker Starling keep getting mentioned on the show. I have to have Chris, Joseph Shabison just mentioned him as well on a recent episode. So,
oh, amazing.
Yeah, so we and Chris has been on the show, but maybe again, time for a return visit. Maybe I'll send an email. So that's nice to hear. From the wonderful new album Air, Light, and Harmony by Badge Epic Ensemble, this is Bowls. Max, always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks for making time for me. I hope you enjoyed yourself, and I wish you the best of luck in the future. Talk soon, I hope.
Thanks, Vish. Take care now.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Always a pleasure to have Max Turnbull on this show. Actually, I did something new. I don't know for those of you who keep track of the show regularly. I have a related episode section of my show notes. I don't know why I didn't think of this sooner. It's so obvious that if someone is discovering the show because of an interview with an artist and that artist has been on the show before or has been talked about in some capacity, why in the heck wouldn't I mention... Sometimes I say it here, but I linked to all as many of the sort of related episodes to Max as I could. So, man, 10 years in, new features on Creative Control. Again, thanks to Max for appearing on episode 814 of this podcast, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available just about wherever you get your podcast. I said podcast a lot more than I usually do there. If you can't find an episode you're looking for, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit vishkana.com. You can also like Creative Control on Facebook still and follow the show on Twitter still at vishcreative, or you can follow me directly on Instagram and on Twitter at vishkana. You can also find me on Blue Sky and Threads and TikTok and lots of other things too. So there's a link tree in the show notes as well. And just click on that and you can follow me wherever you like. I got to update that link tree. There's so many things now. Anyway, enough about that. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to sustain this podcast. $6 American or more a month grants you access to some exclusive content. You also get episodes earlier than everybody else. And also, if you're interested in receiving a Creative Control t-shirt, just message me on Patreon and I'll get you one while supplies last. Oh, that reminds me. I owe a message to someone who asked for a second shirt recently. They wore out their other one. And I said, well, I haven't said anything yet. That's why I got to respond to the email. Sorry, Adam. I'll write you back soon. Thanks again to the wonderful Alberta record retailer Blackbird Music, which you can learn more about at blackbird.ca. That's also where you can go to place special orders or orders that aren't as special. You know, some orders just aren't that special. Let's face it. I also want to thank Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee, respectively, in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, for their in-kind support for this show. Thanks, as always, to my dear friend Jim Guthrie for letting me use some music of his on this podcast. You can learn more about him at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you for listening to this episode with Max Turnbull from Badge Epic Ensemble, but also Symphony Orchestra, a band that took me by surprise. Hard to keep up with everything Max is up to. I hope you like what you've heard on this show from those bands, and we'll check out their new albums. And thanks for listening to the show and spreading the word about it. And that's pretty much it. I will talk to you very soon, I hope. Bye for now.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.